You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 53 for August 2017. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Please visit our website, centersteer.com, C-E-N-T-R-E, the British spelling, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show, of which we will have many. We're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Thanks for your comments, follows, and likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. Special thanks to our Patreon subscribers, and especially thanks to our two new Patreon subscribers over the past few months. Explore More, Charles has been on the show before. His parents wrote the book, Strangers Like Angels, and he has a podcast that has the audio version of the book. So if you want to support that, you can go out to Patreon and support him. But he's now supporting us, so thank you. And also to Eric from California for supporting us on the show. I have your address, and I will put a sticker in the mail today. At least I hope so. The show is also now available over TuneIn, and you can tell Alexa, play the Center Steer Podcast. Do you think we just triggered anybody listening to the show?
Let's get an endless loop going. Alexa, play the podcast.
I like it. That's wonderful. I am your host, John Costage, and joining me from Western Pennsylvania, that's your cue, Harold.
Oh, hello. I'm Harold.
And also joining me from, we do this every month, don't we? You think we'd figure this out by now? Joining me from Vermont.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
And you are the purveyor of seriesparts.com. You should get that little plug in.
Yes, I am providing sources for parts and suppliers and garages around the world,
like Switzerland. Maybe that's coming.
Maybe I'll have to double check my database there.
Yes. Our guests this month have attended the Land Rover Club of Switzerland's Jubilee, which actually now that we understand it better, it's the Jubilee, which took place at the Land Rover Club in Switzerland. Laura Shacklett, who is a member of Texas Rovers and got to visit at SCAR, she talked with Nick Sonderer in Switzerland itself when she was there at the event. And we also talked with Sarah and Mark Caldwell, who are from Georgia, but they also attended the Jubilee in Switzerland. And they talk about the event itself and what happened and other such things. And those interviews will come up after the news. My Continental Overland trip is departing sometime in the future. I don't know when yet exactly. Maybe Harold can tell us anything new.
When the truck is done.
I plan to head northeast and then follow clockwise around the continent and posting pictures on the Center Steer Podcast Instagram account, which is Center Steer Podcast on Instagram. So check that out. Yeah, we're getting closer, right, Harold?
Whenever the truck decides to stop punishing me and making me work for it, it'll get done.
Yeah, I think that's when the truck is done. That's when it stops.
It's making me work for it, though, definitely.
Yeah, that's definitely. I was out yesterday. The roof is on. The back door is in. Engine's in. So there is progress there.
Oh, yeah. It's always progress.
Yeah, I like what I've seen in the photos.
And Eric, who is in Southern California, said that if we're ever out that way and we want to test drive a TD6 Discovery, to let him know. So since when I'm on my trip, I may make a point of getting out there, Eric, and stop by Southern California and maybe you.
Is this the same Eric who is now supporting us on Patreon?
It is not.
Really?
It's a different, different spelling, I believe.
There's more than one Eric in California? Really?
Surprising.
Shocking, I know. Shocking, I tell you.
How big a state is it?
It's very small. It's just like Switzerland. There are bunkers and...
Yeah, and it's far less than 10% of the American population.
All right, let's get into the news, shall we? News, Land Rover and Land Rover related news for the month. Jaguar Land Rover, JLR, sales in North America, well, in the U.S., for July of 2017 were down a bit for the month, especially compared to July of 2016. Overall, though, JLR is up 15% in the U.S. over 2016. So while they had a little dip this month, both in Jaguar and Land Rover sales total, they're up 15% compared to last year, which was last year was also a record-breaking year for Jaguar Land Rover here in North America. Some specific highlights: Land Rover sold almost 6,000 units in July, which is their second best July ever. The Range Rover itself had its best July since 2013, up 21%. In sales from previous July. The Range Rover Sport did well. There's no percentage there. The Discovery Sport was up 9% from the previous year. So, yeah, things are looking good-ish.
And was last year the first year of Discovery Sport, or am I...
I think that's about the right time.
Am I misremembering?
No, no, it was the last year. I'm just trying to remember what month. I want to say, did it start in June or May of last year, I think? That's...
Something like that yeah. Right.
So I think that's finally why we're now starting to see Discovery Sport number comparisons specifically, because now they can do year to year. Things are okay here in North America, but sales were down around the world, in the UK, North America, and Europe for JLR, but they were up in China 34%. So overall, Jag Land Rover worldwide was up 3.6%. They sold 46,000 units in July. So, you know, a little bit of a dip here in the U.S., generally still doing well.
It's good to see Land Rover doing very well in China, considering that there's, what was that knockoff? That
the Land Wind.
Land Wind or Land Wing. I can't remember.
It's Land.
Yeah.
It was Wind.
It is Wind. The Cherry Land Wind.
Gotcha.
Yes, which I think they're still making, by the way. I mean, while Land Rover has kind of partnered and has plants there making stuff on site, I think Cherry is still making these knockoffs, I believe.
I think so. You know, it's one of those things, though, where, you know, it really is the brand that drives them to that instead of the mm-hmm. knockoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My understanding is that Chinese are very brand conscious. And so, you know, I think that's another reason why Land Rover had to make a point of actually producing in China so that they could, you know, get that, because they're brand conscious, so they do want that. They want that brand, even if there are knockoffs available.
Well, I think the brand consciousness is what drives the knockoffs. Another example of that, obviously not automotively, but if you go down the street in New York City, you're going to see stands selling fake Gucci bags, which those wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the real ones.
Exactly. And my favorite from walking through Chinatown in New York City is buying Chanel bags instead of Chanel. Definitely seen those.
Related to all that, I think the reason that Buick still exists as a manufacturer anywhere in the world is in the 30s, Buick was the big name in China as a car. And so when mainland China started kind of being a little more capitalistic and selling cars, that Buick name stuck. And when General Motors, you know, started to kind of close, you know, like shut down Oldsmobile, shut down Pontiac, I don't think the reason they didn't shut down Buick, I believe, was because it has this big name. It's a well-known name in China, so they continued the Buick name. I think that's there's your brand, more brand consciousness.
You know, I remember a day when the American market used to keep a brand going.
I know.
Now it's China.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yep, that's what's happened. Yep.
Yep.
All right, moving on to dependability, the JD Power Dependability Survey, and this took place in the UK. And this is the rates of manufacturers by number of faults recorded by owners after 12 to 36 months of ownership per 100 cars during the last 12 months. So basically, after they've owned the car for a while, what is there things that are still annoying them, pissing them off, or broken? You know, there could be something squeaking. There's another example, and I can't find those examples right now, but the things, you know, that, that cause a problem, that do not, that impact the ownership experience. So Land Rover is not at the bottom. At the bottom is
Hey, we're not last. We're not last.
From the bottom, BMW with 198. The average industry average is 131. Again, that's false. So BMW at the bottom, 198. Audi, 187. And then Land Rover at 175. Just above them is Fiat, Dacia, Citroen, Mitsubishi, and move up from there. At the very top, so these are ones that are below the industry average. You have Kia, Volvo, Skoda, Suzuki, and Hyundai, all under 100 faults. Yeah, so
there's two things that are interesting about that. One is that down at the bottom is mostly luxury vehicles, and up at the top is mostly inexpensive vehicles, with the exception of Volvo.
Yeah, good point.
And I would attribute that just in guessing to two things. One being obviously the number of added fancy features that are in the luxury vehicles. So there's more to go wrong. Yeah. And so, you know, those top vehicles are mostly simple, with the exception of Volvo again. But the other part is that those less expensive vehicles, people probably don't have as high standards for them. So they're less likely to be complaining about fit and finish and, you know, annoying bumps and sounds and stuff like that, because they don't care. They bought the cheap car.
I would add a third factor into that. Again, with the exception of Volvo, the other brands that were mentioned are largely Asian brands, and that's just part of the Asian religion, if you will, is zero defects. They take that stuff very seriously.
Right, definitely. Yeah, and I would also, you know, I wonder seeing, I mean, I'm not terribly surprised seeing BMW at the very bottom, but I know that BMW is one of those companies who also sort of builds in all of their maintenance into the purchase price. I wonder how much that has to play with it, you know, because you might have BMW owners who are just constantly taking them back to the dealer for small little issues because right. It's all supposed to be covered in their maintenance plan.
Well, there's other the things as I say, thanks for talking, gave me time to look at the article a little more closely again. Yeah, there are other things involved. It's not just necessarily fit and finish. We're also talking fuel economy, technology, you know, those kinds of satisfaction things too, so play into it. But your points are well taken. I think that, you know, that you have these high luxury cars, there's a lot going on with them, and then there's the, you know, the owners, they're probably, since they're spending more money, they're expecting it to be better and probably not cause as much issue with them, for them.
Now, I wonder what Volvo is putting in their air conditioning systems to get such good ratings.
I don't know. Good question.
I mean, I am a Volvo fan, but still.
Are they still owned by Ford?
No. They're owned by a Chinese company.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
They are now a Chinese car company.
Oh, interesting. Yep. Okay. I thought they
were. Yeah,
okay.
It was interesting owning a Volvo for a number of years during that transition, because I used to generally buy genuine parts and install them myself. So I got to see the transition from parts being manufactured in Sweden or elsewhere in Europe to being manufactured in China and India. Still, the, you know, genuine branded parts, but suddenly the country of origin started changing on the parts labels.
Well, Land Rover, as you know, we've seen reliability gotten better, and now dependability seems also to have gotten better, but they're still towards the bottom, which kind of, I think, kind of fits with things I hear still anecdotally, right? Yeah. All right, moving
Hopefully
on.
It's still continuing upwards, though.
I think so. I think so. I think, well, yeah, I would say it does. It certainly, but But what you've also noticed, and this happened, you even saw it with the American car companies, is their fit and finish and reliability and durability was crap. And then they said, we need to get better, and they did get better. But the problem was that the rest of the industry also got better. Like, they were upping their game as the Americans have been playing catch up, and I think that Land Rover at this point is playing catch up too.
You're saying that the British are playing catch up?
Moving on.
In vehicle quality.
Yes. Yes.
Well, how could they do anything else? I mean, you know, they
right,
can't be
exactly
playing any worse.
So true.
But it's interesting. You made a comment about watching the countries of origin change on your parts. I've been noticing that with series and Defender parts I've been ordering. The countries of origin, of course, are evolving, and there's more stuff coming from India, which makes some sense. But really, things are much more global than they used to be. I still get a lot of parts that come from the UK. Well, I mean, they all come from the UK, but of course, the invoice, when you get it, spells out the country of origin on every part. And the interesting thing is that it's not necessarily that a certain kind of part is made in a certain country, although there is some of that. The variations are much weirder than that. Case in point, the plastic trims that go on around the headlights on John's truck, the right-hand one is made in India. The left-hand one is made in Turkey.
Oh, wow. Bidding war there?
I don't know. And actually, oddly enough, some other parts I've noticed is, you know, the left side is made in one country and the right side's made in the other.
That is bizarre.
Yeah. Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
It
those
is.
Those bean counters.
It must be, yeah. And you know, like you buy axle half shafts and the short ones are made in India and the long ones are made in Vietnam. or it's the other way around. I can't remember now. But yeah, that's just the odd stuff you see.
Right. Yeah. Crazy.
It's a very global product now.
Moving on, Jag Land Rover wants its future cars to be more aerodynamic, which is that's not news itself. Car makers have always been trying.
Yeah, who
that.
Doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. right. They go faster. They go faster with using less fuel. Yeah, exactly. We talked about this a couple months ago, too, that there was Land Rover was looking at the D or C pillar, depending on the vehicle, putting air into the pillar to have it kind of duck into that so that it was more efficient and had less drag on it. And this article says that Land Rover has patented some more things to do that, like as I'm talking, I missed it. Deployable vanes up front. When not in use, the strakes would be flush and with the vehicle's body, but they would extend onto the road. I assume that means not onto the road itself, but just on road, to clean up the airflow ahead of the front wheel. The devices could also rotate for fine-tuning aero adjustments, and the body also sees active extending side sills. These would help channel air inward toward a rear diffuser. Of course, there's some panels in the rear corner that might pop out and let air in, similar to the D pillar. So there's a number of these channeling things, and it's the fact that, you know, folks, car companies have been thinking about this stuff for a long time, but they're now, I think, reaching the point where they can do these things and actually implement them into the vehicle. Because you got the computers that can know when it's time to deploy something. It's probably a little cheaper than it was in the past, maybe in some mechanical way.
It all reminds me of Knight Rider back in the 80s when he went into super pursuit mode.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, and the other part of it is, you know, we're sort of getting to the point where you have to pull out all the stops to get the efficiencies, especially for fuel efficiency, that we need. Mm-hmm. Specifically for large vehicles like Land Rover's SUVs. Mm-hmm. They're not small, light vehicles that are much more naturally aerodynamic.
Right.
So they have to use a lot of tricks.
Well, and the tricks become more and more important, too, because aerodynamics is largely dependent upon speed. And so if you have a vehicle that doesn't go fast, you have to do more with what you have.
Right. And it actually, you know, some of these things that we're seeing, a lot of them sound, you know, not all of them to some of the racing circuit, but a lot of them come from technologies that they've learned through racing. And it kind of reminds me of...
That's the best argument for racing programs that has ever existed.
Yeah.
All the cool stuff comes from racing.
Definitely. And it reminds me of some of the Group B rally racing where they were pushing insane amounts of horsepower. And
oh, those things were incredibly badass.
They were so badass, but they brought us so many of the technologies that we have now, like all-wheel drive, and so much of that technology came out of the Group B rally racing.
Well, I mean, the Porsche 959 that was developed for Group B but didn't make it in time before they closed the circuit down, but that had all the stuff that's becoming commonplace now was on the 959 way back when.
Exactly. Yeah, that was an amazing vehicle.
Oh, yeah. It's too bad he didn't actually get to run it in Group B. But Group B was only around for 4 years, and then they shut it down because they discovered that the cars were so incredibly efficient at killing people.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
especially spectators who didn't have the sense to not stand at the edge of the road and lean into the roadway.
Yeah.
Right, because it was such a... There was such a quick evolution, and there were so many restrictions on the vehicles that they were really going so fast. There was just it was way too risky for the spectators. But they were still, taking classic rally mentality. Oh, right. You have a little bit of time to get out of the way. No, you don't.
No, you don't.
No, you don't. All right, the 2018 Range Rover Velar first drive. So the looks like Land Rover had an event in Norway, and a number of journalists got to drive the Velar there. And so we'll have a couple links to different articles in it. A couple things that I kind of wanted to mention from it was, at least for America, looks like there will be a turbo diesel at about $56,000. There'll be a supercharged V6, $64,000, and you can also get a turbocharged four-cylinder for about $50,000. Folks, I think this – so that's some specifics for it. But what I'm – and we'll have a discussion a little bit about Jerry McGovern, additional comments he's made. But I think this is a good example of what McGovern has been talking about with the – and design being equal to engineering with Land Rover at Land Rover, which is a change in their philosophy from the previous, up until Tata took over.
That was actually Mr. Tata's mandate, as I recall.
I think this vehicle is a prime example of that. That's what this is the embodiment of all that coming together. You see a touchscreen display with two knobs. It's very sleek. The door handles pop out. Versus being always visible and out front. So this is that vehicle. I think this is
I'm very much a fan of design and engineering being on equal level. I think they should be equal. I just really don't want to see the day come when design becomes more equal than engineering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly. And, from an engineering standpoint, I'm an IT guy. I understand going the direction of simplicity in terms of consolidating some of that technology, like moving to touchscreens. In some ways, for a vehicle, I like physical buttons that you can touch and feel without having to look away. but I like toggle switches.
Well,
you can feel whether they're supposed to be on and off even when the circuit isn't working.
Exactly.
But those knobs are not always as good as people think they are. I do like the tactile feel of knobs. I get that. Yeah, talking about durability and fit and finish of as we did earlier, there are one of the things, there's like three things that I really despise about my Jetta, as much as I really like the Jetta. One of them is that those knobs are small. And the displays are so small that there are times when I've had to pull over because I need to redirect the air so I have, can defog the window, for example, and you have to pull over because I'm like, which setting is it? And you can't read it. They're so small and they're tough to read. So while, yes, knobs are nice, you still got to implement it well. And I think that's an example where Volkswagen has not.
And that's why I like the Series 3 air knob controls. It's only got four settings, and it's pretty damn obvious whether.
Well, you know, well, my Series 3, you know, the
window as in
or closed or stuck.
I was going to say your four settings would be cold, colder yet, and really cold.
Yes. I have
in the winter.
Yes,
that's right. True. Exactly.
Well, you know, as I said about series trucks, it has climate control. Whatever the climate is outside is the climate inside. It's controlled by the weather. Yeah.
And it's speed reference.
It is.
The faster you drive, the more the air blows.
That's right. And I really like the wipers because they have two settings, on and off.
Yeah. I thought they'd be off and broken.
Yeah, working, not working, yeah. Working, not working. Yeah, well, yeah, back to modern cars.
Working is the right word.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, but back to modern vehicles, you know, having all of the physical switches, all of the wiring and all of the control modules to handle all the wiring for lots of buttons and switches and knobs and all of that stuff. That's pretty complex. When you can slim it down to a single touchscreen interface that's larger, easier to see, can be changed.
Changed after being produced too, which is the nice thing.
Right. Changed after being produced so you can see what works well, what doesn't. It's much easier to just provide a software fix for a lot of the issues. And then you just have a generally more central computer that's controlling a lot of the things. That saves a lot of the engineering and the maintenance. Not all of it, because you still have a hell of a lot of wiring. And honestly, these days, probably even more wiring.
The trend actually is towards less wiring because more and more things are being multiplexed. There's the word.
That's true. Yeah.
Separate control modules. There's like a station in each door, for instance, that handles all of the door functions. And so it's a simple one power wire and a network cable that links the door to the rest of the vehicle.
Right. Yeah. And with the more modern bus technology used, it's definitely getting simpler. So, you know, in many ways, I like from both the technology and the design standpoint of, you know, those central touch screens and stuff like that.
They're great till you have to try and fix them.
Exactly.
Well, and also, what's the durability and dependability of these down the road? I think that's another consideration is will it hold up to your wear and tear and being beat on, you know, if you're going to take it off road, you know, the car is bouncing around on the rocks, you know, over time, how do these things hold up? Will they still be able to function in the same way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will say generally, if you look at tablets, unless they're actually dropped, you know, like iPads and iPhones, they're actually pretty durable. And, you know, companies are actually now supporting older models for a longer period of time. It used to be that you bought a computer and a company supported it for maybe 3 years and that was it. Now some of the companies are supporting them for 5 or 6 years. I think the technologies are getting much more durable and it is in some ways easier to replace one tablet than, you know, a half a dozen switches and buttons.
Oh yeah.
But it's still
just for all of our techie information security listeners, which I'm sure there are more than I think. I know there's
more than you want to know about.
Yes, I know. We're not going to talk about it, but I will at least let you know that yes, I know about it and reference it. That there is a major vulnerability to the process of cars and the CAN bus. How the central computer talks to all of the other computers. There's a major vulnerability that can only be fixed by changing the process and doing a lot of tech to it. So yes, I'm aware of that. It's out there. All the things we're talking about here. Yeah, we know that's out there. We're not going to worry about the information security aspect of it, of a car being remotely controlled or destroyed or changed.
So, actually, the CAN bus is quite secure as long as there's no radios in the vehicle.
And that's part of this vulnerability is the fact that now this stuff is more connected and it's easier, and then there are no controls between the different devices, and the only way they see to fix this is to basically start over again, is kind of the short answer to that. One of the other interesting things, for my information security folks, of which I'm one, I know that's out there, we'll kindly ignore that for the time being.
I prefer to just keep my vehicles, my modern vehicles, locked away in a Faraday cage.
Well, a friend of mine who actually helped out with that, he was part of the team that helped with that GPAC that took place from between Pittsburgh and I think it was St. Louis. I messaged him about this, and he said, and I said, "Oh, this looks pretty serious." And he goes, "Yeah, it is." And I go, "Well, I know my Series 3 is safe. You're not going to be remotely taking control of that unless you get into it. And even then, you might have problems.
You don't really directly take control of the vehicle from the driver's seat even. So,
well,
Series
said,
truck
sir.
Does what it's going to do. All you can do is suggest where it needs to go next.
Exactly.
You are absolutely
vague
right.
Steering, slow acceleration, almost non-existent braking. It's...
One of our friends says you don't drive a Series truck. You just herd it.
Yes.
That's right.
And if you have no experience herding a Series Land Rover and somebody else is going to jump in and try to control it, good luck to them.
Yeah.
So, they are one of the most theft-resistant vehicles in this country, and which is ironic given how they're stolen so readily in England. But here, nobody understands them.
Nope.
So nobody steals them.
Right. Well, I think we're losing the number of people who even know how to drive a manual transmission.
And my point exactly is that car thieves can't drive stick. Right-hand drive scares the hell out of them. And when they can't drive stick and there's four sticks coming up through the floor, it's really confusing in a hurry.
So back to the modern Velar. The Wired magazine out of the UK also was part of this review of it. And one thing stuck out to me on this one is the lighting system, which is really interesting. So Land Rover has made much of – I'm going to read from the article here. Land Rover has made much of its new lights on the Velar with good reason. The super slim matrix laser LED headlights perform a few tricks. First, if certain conditions are met, such as a straight road with no oncoming traffic as you go over 50 miles per hour, the Velar should automatically kick in its laser high beam, which can illuminate your path up to a thumping 550 meters in front of the car. And the adaptive front lighting system not only matches the light beam to the steering wheel angle, it can also, quote-unquote, shield oncoming vehicles from the glare of headlights. The car uses an algorithm to monitor your speed and the oncoming car's speed. It then works out which of the 32 LEDs in the light array matrix on the driver's side to switch off as it tracks the car ahead as it approaches and passes. That was a tough sentence to read. So that's impressive, as they say here, considering the calculations have to be done while you're driving at speed.
Also, that you don't have to use the dimmer switch.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like, offloading a huge amount of algorithmic effort to the car when the human brain should be able to easily detect light ahead on the road.
And no,
just
should be able to.
Beams off.
Should be able to, but it's too lazy to do it.
The number of times I see people switch off their high beams is pretty few these days.
I'll bring you down here. People not paying attention at all to driving, let alone whether the light's on, off, or otherwise. But yeah, well, this is
well,
also
it's that, and it's also making sure that your lights are aimed properly in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
True.
And guys go, especially with the trucks, they put a big lift on it, and then they don't give any consideration to the fact that they need to re-aim their headlights.
Exactly. So some of this technology reminds me of, who was it in the, was it the 30s or so? I want to say it was Buick, but I can't remember. Somebody had patented the headlights that swiveled with the...
It was Tucker.
With the tires.
Tucker had that in the center headlight.
Oh, yeah, it was Tucker.
I don't know that he was really he was ahead of the game, but I don't think he necessarily invented that. But then the most common implementations of the swiveling headlight was the center headlight in the Tucker and the European version of the Citroen DS.
Oh, gotcha. Right.
So the new Velar is out. If you purchase one and you wish us to do some road testing, we're happy to We're happy to do that. Just contact us as we offer to any vehicle that you might have that certainly is very interesting. We're happy to road test it for you, and we'll talk about it on the show. Moving on, we know this. We've talked about it before, but another article came up, and it's a little more further confirmed. So the Land Rover Defender might come to America in 2019. As I said, we know this. This is supposed to come to the U.S.
Yeah. But it's least breaking news ever.
But it's been further confirmed, I suppose, that we're looking at a 2019 production model. It is supposed to be offered in all global markets, which would include North America. And for our non-North American listeners, as you may or, well, you probably already know, it's, you know, the Defender's not been available here since 97. And so hopefully it's going to come back, and this seems to reprise all that.
At least not legally.
Legally though, you can bring it in. Legally.
At least not legally, it hasn't been available through dealers and such. Yeah,
right.
So there's very little detail, and all this is all speculation. The main speculation in these two articles here were around: is it going to be unibody or body on frame? And so I think it's basically the next big thing is how, you know.
I would be shocked if it was body on frame.
I think it might still be body on frame. I'm in that camp. I just think that you get.
It would be nice. I'd like it, but I would be shocked given how much Land Rover is moving towards number one common platform, which is unibody at the moment. But in the interest of saving weight and the structural integrity and all that stuff, I'm thinking they pretty much have to be unibody at this point.
Right. Yeah, it would cost more for them to do body on frame at this point.
And well, yeah, because all their tooling is set up for unibody, and like I said, it's, you know, the way they're going to save costs on this stuff is to go common platform. And, you know, as much as I really hate to see a 100-inch Defender, because they already have the 100-inch covered on everything else, but, you know, they went to great lengths to defend moving the Range Rover and Disco into unibody, and for them to make a body on frame Defender at this point would be perceived as a big backpedal, and that's not what they do.
Well, yeah. I guess I'm in the other camp that if they've talked about, and it's a number of times of having this, most likely, and it seems like they're going to. Maybe it's a better way to put it. It seems like they want to have all the versions that they had in the Defender, having a larger size, having a pickup, having a four door, and having a two door, and they want to continue that in the new Defender range. It seems it would be easier to do that on body on frame than unibody, and that's.
It's not undoable in unibody. It just makes development cost becomes a factor. It just means that they would start with one model and then add others in the future.
Right.
I mean, I agree that it would be easier to make it flexible and reconfigurable in body on frame. I just can't see them doing it.
Right.
All right, well, we continue, obviously, in our Defender watch, and that's kind of the latest. Looks like we're still looking at a 2019 with a model with a 2018 debut, and so there you go.
Well, we'll end the discussion, as we always do, by saying time will tell.
And as we've been doing for the past several months, there have been a number of interviews with Land Rover's design director, Jerry McGovern, and there was another interview with him, and there's several of them, and we're going to talk about them as a kind of a group here, but the I'll read off the titles here. The first one was Land Rover's design boss on Range Rover Velar and the brand's growth. There's one here about Land Rover's looking to expand the Discovery range. There's no plans for a 7-seat Range Rover, and Jerry McGovern says younger generation will drive forward-looking future design. Oh, there's another one.
Well, what choice do they have?
And Land Rover design director doesn't want to slaughter all the cows for car interiors. So we kind of talk about all these as a grouping. So if you want to take a look at those articles, the one you really want to read is the one from Autocar. And the subtitle here helps. This was Steve Cropley wrote the article and I guess did the interview. Jerry McGovern is feisty, sure of his mind, and never afraid to speak it. And his leadership has garnered a long line of design savvy hits that have helped bring enviable sales growth. And so he talked to McGovern in London, in his London home, from what we gather here. As Harold mentioned, you know, the one thing that came out of this, confirmed, we've heard this before, but kind of confirmed with Jerry, is when Tata took over Land Rover, president, CEO, I guess, of Tata came in and was like, hey, why is he? He's a car guy himself from
actually, it was Mr. Tata himself, the big cheese.
Yep.
And he's a car guy himself, and he wondered why is design and why is design reporting to engineering? And so that, I guess that was the first change he made, was have design and engineering working together and not one reporting to the other.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that he was, you know, trained as an architect, so in that way, you know, design and engineering are very much on a level plane.
You're talking about Mr. Tata.
Tata.
Yeah, he was a trained architect. Yeah, so that's why that's true. That's why he said that. Which, so I think that's why you've seen this revolution in Land Rover's design. And of course, the first one was the Evoque. Did I say that right?
You did.
Oh, thank you. You did for a change, yes.
McGovern did say at some point that he doesn't like the front end. The overhang wasn't right. He didn't go into any more detail. But that was the first expression of this.
A chink in his armor.
Because
normally everything Jerry does is wonderful.
Right. He didn't get the perfection he was after.
Well, but I think he did get that in the Velar. I think that was the current expression of all that. And all these articles, kind of, when you read them and you look at the Velar, you see all of that come together in the Velar. The modernist movement with simplicity and, simple design and not a lot of, in the cars world, not a lot of knobs and, not a lot of things going on, but you can, you have the displays that can handle all that. You see that in the Velar, the sleekness on the outside, the door handles mentioned before that as an expression of that. And then of course the materials on the inside, which is, folks wanting to get away from using animal skins for that. So Tesla is doing, and now Land Rover is doing it also.
Yes, we're going vegan.
And which, since we're on this, the other thing I despise about my Jetta, so we have those knobs, is the seats. They have this leatherette seating, which is just horrible. Doesn't breathe at all.
Yeah, and, fancy word for plastic.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And Land Rover's doing the same thing. They have a fancy word for some recycled plastic bottles that they have. But they're also using wool, which I thought was interesting.
Wool is an English tradition.
Yeah, which
and that's really wool and walnut are what makes the British car experience.
Well, and I will say, for your comment on having faux leather seats that don't breathe, wool is an amazing breathable fabric.
Yes.
It retains its insulating factor significantly better when wet. It breathes very well. It's naturally antimicrobial. So,
And it is a sustainable and renewable resource.
It is. That is true.
You cut the wool off the sheep and it grows back.
Yeah, imagine that.
You don't have to remove its skin.
Right.
The one interesting thing about all these articles that, and this was a good interview with Jerry, and of course the other articles, as I mentioned, there's never been a mention of the Defender, which, as we've just mentioned, is kind of Land Rover's roots, but it's also different, I think, than where Land Rover is now, and what's going to happen with the new version, what it's going to be. And there's no mention of that in this article, which concerns me a bit, because
it's actually refreshing, because I get tired of hearing every time it's coming, it'll be great, it'll be appealing, you will like it. Because if they ask him, that's exactly what he's going to say. That's why they don't bother to ask him anymore.
How is that impacted by his thoughts on design and engineering being one? Where are they and how is that working out? I mean, those questions should have been asked as part of this, because they are very relevant. And I think to inform us as to what the new Defender might be like. Is it not mentioned because maybe engineering is maybe slightly a little higher in the discussion for the new Defender than is design? It's possible that the Defender might be led by the engineering folks and then the design may come in. Or is there really going to be, these synergies, as he likes to use that word, going on with that model? That should have been asked. Even if he just does say, you're going to like it, maybe probe him a little more, because clearly he was open to discussion on many things and said some things. Ask the question, see what he would say, and maybe ask the pointed question. Where are you on the Defender? How much are you involved in the design / engineering aspects of it?
On the other hand, if engineering really is still at the forefront of the Defender development, maybe he just doesn't want to talk about it. Because he's sore, because he's not being revered on this deal.
It's very possible.
I think he would probably not want to talk about it anyway, just because he's trying to talk about his newest baby, the Valar. So.
Right, and toot his own horn and show the justification through, you know, all the increased sales justify what he's done to the design of the product. And the Defender has no sales history yet, so it doesn't meet his ideals right now of proving his point.
Exactly.
He also indicated that Ian Cullum, who is his opposite number over at Jaguar, that he and the JLR president, that's Spaeth, right? Ralph Spaeth. They get together once a month and talk about the cars and the models, because there was a question about, did the Valar and the F-Pace being on the same platform? And the way he kind of indicated was that the way I took it, Valar was started maybe before the F-Pace, but then the F-Pace, Jaguar needed some money, needed an SUV, so they rolled that out first.
Well, they think Jaguar needed an SUV. I don't agree, but yes, I see your point.
Yeah, and it sounded like he was maybe a little hurt by some of the discussions saying that the Valar is built on the F-Pace platform, that he wanted to sort of clarify, no, well, this is sort
right.
of...
Right, he wants the credit.
Right.
He wants the credit for it.
But there were synergies. Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
It is still a shared platform.
I mean, which is okay. It's okay to share platforms as long as it's not obvious that you did it.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, like General Motors with the X cars in the early 80s.
And he also mentioned in a different article that, the brand has the ability to stretch. And he was referring to the Discovery. I know you guys know all this, but, we have the Range Rover. We have the Range Rover Sport. We have the Valar. We have the Evoque. And now on the Discovery, we currently have Discovery and Discovery Sport. And with the Valar coming out, it seems like there might be – there's room in the Discovery range to have another model. So that's something to potentially look forward to on the Discovery side, which is going to – which wise also may possibly inform the Defender. Will there be – a Defender, and it will be a Defender Sport. Will there be different grades of them? Will they call it a Defender Sport? I don't know. But these all things kind of factoring in.
You'd think they would have one they call a Sport.
Will that be the?
Yeah, I would think so.
It seems so logical.
It does. Will that be the smaller one? Will the 110 be the Defender, and the 90 be the Sport then?
If I were doing it, that's how I would. I would.
Yeah. That maybe happen. And then there'll be a Defender Valar.
I hope not. I really hope not. I mean, if you got to have a mid-grade Defender, that's great. But, pick a name.
Yep. And Jerry's definitely got this interesting obsession with filling in all the white space. And I'm sure that some of that is the bean counters and the marketing side as well, but
there's that, but it's also an opportunity for him to design more product.
True, very true. Yeah,
more accomplishments in his portfolio, you might say.
Yep. Well, I just miss the nice negative space that used to be around each model in the Land Rover lineup.
Well, I miss when there was just one. It was called the Land Rover.
Me too.
Well,
I would have been happy with Land Rover and Range Rover. Perfect.
Right, exactly. That was the whole point. You had the Land Rover and the Range Rover.
Well, clearly there's a market, and they were filling the market, and they have, and other companies have found other places to fill a market and compete with them. And then this is also showing that Land Rover has, I think, built a good part of this market, the SUV market, and they're looking for those areas where people want to spend their money and they want something slightly different. And that's clearly been obvious when the Evoque has sold way more than they ever and originally anticipated, especially for a Land Rover. And they've sold a crap ton of them. And that's good for the model, for the brand overall. It brings in money so that you can then continue to build other things like the Defender. So while, yes, I see all your points, there's people out there wanting to buy. And why should they not try to fill those markets? And hopefully that gives them then some room to allow to build things that we might like and a little more in our area, which are also niche to be candid. You know, that's what, you know, Volkswagen does that. Mercedes does it. BMW does it. You know, they have some cars maybe that are out there that people like to buy, but then allows them to do some special one-off stuff. And I guess other car companies do it too.
The question in my mind is that, you know, there's a certain cost involved with developing a new model. Yeah, maybe it boosts sales to have that new model, but if they took the amount of money they spent on developing that new model and marketed the ones they had more completely, what would the difference be in sales?
Right. Yeah, there's a huge cost in designing and building out the manufacturing side and everything.
Well, yeah. I see your point, but
I get that you know that there are people out there who want to buy something, so you're going to make more things to give them choices, but how about if they just knew more about the stuff that already existed? Maybe they are not buying because they don't know.
It's very possible. I don't know. I see lots of Land Rover advertising.
But the Land Rover advertising you see doesn't really talk about the product. You see a guy driving through dunes with a bunch of guys in the back. I mean, which is great, but it doesn't really talk about the product. It's the brand.
Well, that's because that's how you buy things, I think. That's what appeals to you. And I'm, you
know, that's what I'm seeing in the advertising.
Oh, no, I see that in the advertising too, the way to appeal to Harold to sell something is to show a certain set of criteria and to show capabilities and to show certain things to sell to someone else may not
be
the same way.
Of course, because that's what matters.
To you, right.
But if you're choosing – but when you go into a dealership and you're legitimately shopping for a vehicle and let's just say you don't know anything, but you need a vehicle, so you're going to go to the dealer, you're going to look around – you know, somebody there is going to tell you about each one and what its details are. That's going to drive your decision at some point.
But you need to get people. That's the whole. You said it. You need to get people in the dealership. So there. Okay. That's marketing's job is to get people in the dealership. Then they're going to turn over to the sales guy, salesperson.
Right. But you could talk product at the same time and get people coming in to see that particular product.
And the flip side is that I think companies are finding that buyers these days are not necessarily sold on what features and abilities vehicles have. It's more on the design and feel and
that's what's wrong with the car buying public, by the way.
I agree. And I've actually found that a lot of the dealerships around here, most of the sales staff are actually not all that knowledgeable on what the vehicles offer. Now, part of that is probably because I'm a car guy, and so I go and I research and I learn all those specs before I go in.
I've not known less than the dealer about the product he's selling since maybe back in the 70s when I was a little kid.
I would disagree with you, Morgan, that people do in fact buy on features, but they just buy on features that you seem that you don't agree with. They're buying on tech. They're buying on fuel economy. They're buying on on other things.
Cup holder quantity, for instance.
And and potentially how much cargo it takes, and whether it has child seats, or how easy it is to get in and out. They're a different set of features. I mean, they are buying features, but they're buying on a different set of features than you and I and Harold are typically look at a vehicle.
No, I do actually agree with you on that, but it's also, I think, that most vehicles these days have most of the features that the average buyer wants. So very few cars are they really, you know, aside from price, maybe a little bit on fuel mileage, but
Now you're back to selling the brand. Then, so you, what's the differentiator?
Right.
The differentiator is we have this heritage. You can put seven guys in it and outrun a tornado or whatever that was, that storm. Now you're selling a lifestyle. You're selling a brand. You're not, they're doing the things that you're talking about.
Right, and that's what I was saying, I agree with Harold that I would prefer that they didn't come out with so many models that filled in extra gaps and instead spent that on marketing to sell the vehicles, you know, fewer vehicles overall and sell on the features. But I think that, you know, people are now buying more on their impression and their feel of the vehicle, so on the design and lifestyle side, than on the features themselves. So,
well, there you go.
At least in this market segment, maybe. But yeah, right. On the other hand, a lot of manufacturers have very product targeted commercials, like for instance the minivans, where they show you the doors that open by themselves and that sort of thing.
Right.
Features.
Yeah.
All right. So finally, we're going to talk about Land Rover. It's not Land Rover related, but it kind of looks like a Land Rover. The Bollinger Motors V1 prototype is an all-electric sport utility truck. And this looks pretty badass, actually.
And honestly, this is if I was designing the new Defender, this would be it.
Yes, agreed.
It does.
That was my thought as well.
It's future technology. But it still looks like a Defender.
It's very boxy. You can take a look at the picture in the show notes with the article.
It's boxy, but the corners are rounded, just like a Defender should be.
Yep.
Has a 60 kilowatt battery that gives you 120 mile range. It has a 100 kilowatt battery that can go for 200
kilowatt
miles.
Hours, by the way.
Oh, it does. There's the H there. Thank you. Kilowatt hours. The dual electric motors put out the equivalent of 360 horsepower, 470 pound-feet of instant torque. It is from a Bollinger's in New York, right? Yes, upstate New York.
Yeah. Yes.
Their goal is 10,000 to 20,000 units sometime in 2019, when the new Defender comes out, by the way.
Clever, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, that we've talked about this before. There is a market and there's competition for the Defender. You know, it's here and happening in the U.S.
And what I think is interesting is their marketing, some of their early marketing stuff that I've seen, their promotional videos and stuff, they're really trying to appeal to contractors. There's onboard power tool outlets on the vehicle. And the fact that the really cool thing is that there's a tailgate in the back, like you'd expect, and there's a tailgate in the front. And there's a tailgate in the middle, if you will. You can drop this panel between the passenger and where the engine would be on a normal vehicle. And then you can open up the front grille and you can slide long lumber right on through. And they actually tell you in the specs how many 2x12s it will carry, how many 2x4s it'll carry, and what lengths.
Cool. Impressive.
Yeah.
Makes it sound great for overlanding if it had a longer than, you know, a couple hundred mile range, but
but again, that's really what we keep talking about with electric vehicles. That's the big obstacle.
But then again, you know, here in the U.S. it's becoming less of an obstacle because there are now charging stations within, you know, a couple hundred miles.
Speed of the recharge is still the limiting factor there. You're going to be a while charging it. You can't just like pull up to the pump and pump some electrons into your battery.
Yeah, you're not going to be there for 5 minutes. I think Tesla,
right.
I think
But it could be more the kind of situation where you just sort of show up. Maybe you go and eat some dinner or you grill up a meal, you know.
Right.
Well, they're working, and they are working on the faster charging. It does. Tesla says you can do 80% of the battery in like 15 minutes. So it's not.
It's definitely better. And also, if you think about, you know, who they're targeting in their initial promotion, you know, the contractors and work truck guys, you know, they don't drive long distances typically.
No.
Right.
If you're going to use it as a work truck, for instance. But you know, the interesting thing technically about the way they designed this vehicle is that everything fits down between the frame rails, which keeps the center of gravity very compact, but also it gives you that room on top of the frame to slide the lumber through and do all the stuff that I talked about, because there's no batteries, no motor, none of that stuff's in the way. Everything is down low between the frame rails.
Yeah, that is brilliant.
Yeah, it's great.
And it should be kick-ass. Don't think I'd mentioned this before, but I think after last month I got to test drove a Model X, which is a Tesla SUV. That thing was wicked cool, expensive, but man, it was very, very quick, well done, truck, I suppose. I'm not, you know, it's not designed to carry lumber, mind you, but, it certainly was really cool. And you know, you can see the technology coming, and the future is electric.
Electric vehicles are very cool. I mean, to You'll wake up when you drive one, that's for sure. If you didn't think you liked electric, go drive one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And in fact, soon you'll have to. There's many countries now that are pushing to eliminate the internal combustion engine within 15 or 20 or 30 years. We actually did research, folks, the first time ever on the podcast. We did advanced research. Norway, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head now. Norway, France, India, the UK are all looking to eliminate the internal combustion engine as a new sales of vehicles with an internal combustion engine by 2020.
Yeah, we need to make that clear. They're just not going to be selling new ones. Doesn't mean they're going to come get your old ones.
Right. That is – and you know, the headlines of the various articles are very misleading because they, you know, most of them say ban, you know, petrol and diesel combustion engines.
They're outlawing cars. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, it's not. And even then you get into the first paragraph and they're saying they're going to ban all, you know, sales of these. It's like, no, it's just new models. Like, you're still going to be able to drive.
Got you to read the article.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's just shock jock headlines, basically.
It is, yeah. Which is a shame. I mean, I know that's where our society sort of is at this point. But yeah, it's
always,
you know, we're going to be able to keep driving our vehicles. We're going to be able to still keep selling our, you know, older used vehicles.
Well, but the interesting thing about the thought of that is as you make that switch, and yes, you're still going to be able to drive and still have an internal combustion engine, but at some point, you know, what's going to happen with the having the availability of having gasoline or diesel as you go about and do things? Because as you make the switch over and you know, your gas station then becomes a fuel station truly and has a electric charger in it, as an example, versus having diesel. You know, when does that switch over? Are we going to, in one point?
Actually, I think it's going to put the gas station business out of business because people have charging stations that where they park. They're not going to pull in and fuel up on electricity. I think it's going to put those guys out of business, and it's going to become a specialty store where you buy a 5-gallon can of fossil fuel.
Yeah,
for your collector vehicle.
Yeah, I think honestly, it's probably going to be more like your auto parts stores are just offering to sell the, you know, gallon cans, like you say, along with all of your motor oils and stuff that your electric vehicles are also not using. And, you know, you're most likely going to charge at home and at the grocery store or something like that. We're already seeing that where grocery stores are popular places
or at work.
There's going to be fewer. Yeah, I think we're going to see.
I don't know that we have the death of those
snack shops. As long as we don't go back to buying our gasoline in quart bottles at the drugstore.
Yes.
You need to throw into all this also automated vehicles, because that will certainly change this also. Because you say you'll go charge the vehicle while you're shopping. Well, you may not, because that may not be your vehicle. The vehicle it's going to be like a rideshare situation. It'll pick you up, take you to the grocery store. It'll go off and pick up the next passenger or do what it needs to do. That may not even be consideration anymore.
Or it'll go back and plug itself in like the little robot vacuum cleaners do.
Yeah, exactly. Or it'll find a local charging station, which may have been an old gas station, and charge up there.
The Teslas actually already do that. If you pull in at home, you can get out. It can drive itself into your garage and plug itself in.
Yep. And, newsflash, there will be a Tesla charging station 2 miles from my home by the end of the year. And they're building it at one of the three sheets in my township. There's three of them. I just saw they're starting to build it already. So I just happened to see that yesterday.
Cool.
So we're getting a Tesla charging station. And another interesting point about the Tesla is that I don't think many folks know, they with their onboard GPS and navigation system, you can say you're going to go from here to, let's say, Vermont and visit Vermont. And it will map out the route for you considering when you need to charge. So it may tell you to, drive 2 hours first, stop and charge, and then you drive for maybe 8 hours or something after that. So it factors that in. So that technology also exists to figure out the best route to take when you consider the charging necessary.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's going to become, just a different. It's just going to shift how we schedule things.
I think what this shows is there are big changes coming that none of us have fully understand or know what the implications are going to be. Will gas stations go out of business? Will they become fuel stations? Will you even have personal ownership of a car? All these things are up in the air. Tesla is actually going to, related to all this, Tesla is going to come out with their big rig, which is probably going to be inner city transport, their big rig truck, all electric. That's coming. It's going to be announced next month. So yeah,
they actually have a prototype right now, and they're looking at about a 200-mile range.
Yep. So they're figuring it's going to be kind of regional transport for initially.
Which is a good start, but to really be a factor on the over-the-road trucking industry, they're going to have to really quintuple that.
Oh, the other consideration is I actually haven't looked into that one. With their other vehicles, they've already got quick, 5-minute battery swaps. My guess is that they would look into similar technology for vehicles like that.
I think you'd need a substation to do that, though, on a big truck. Yeah. I mean, you're talking megawatt hours of battery, not just kilowatt hours.
True. I will say that those of us with diesel engines will probably be better off in terms of longevity of running vehicles, past the point where most people are running electrics, because you have a much greater option in terms of what fuels you can run in it, many of which you can basically produce at home.
Right, you can grow your own. That's a good point.
That's the news for August 2017 on the Center Steer podcast. And now on the 53rd edition of the Center Steer podcast, it is time for interviews. And it is the 30th anniversary of the Land Rover Club of Switzerland. It started back in February of 1987 when 8 Land Rover enthusiasts founded the club. And it's open to all Land Rover fans from all regions of Switzerland. It sounds like all around the world, actually. They hold an annual event, and this year the event took place at the St. Stephen Airfield in Switzerland, and it's called the Jubilee. First, we have an interview with Nicholas Saunderer, who's a member of the club, and it was interviewed by our new correspondent, Laura Shacklett. She's with Texas Rovers, and she traveled along with some other members of the club over to Switzerland to attend the event, and she was nice enough to talk to Nicola for us. And then our second interview immediately following Nick is going to be Sarah and Mark Caldwell, also of Texas Rovers. They attended the Jubilee event, and they talked to us about all what their sights and sounds and all they saw, and we just recorded that like an hour ago. So that'll be up right after we talk to Nicholas. I want to thank everybody that went to the event, and they were nice enough to take their time to either, in Laura's case, to record something on site, or in Mark and Sarah to join us here on the show to talk about what they saw. And it was very interesting to hear about the event that took place there. And if you've attended any Land Rover event wherever you are in the world, it'll seem very familiar to you. So now we're going to take you to Switzerland. How's that good? How's that for a transition? And now to Switzerland.
I'm here Monday with Nick in Switzerland. I met Nick at the Jubilee. It's a sponsored event by the Land Rover of Switzerland. And I met him and asked him if I could interview him and just get a few questions and learn about him and his rovers and what brought him to be a Land Rover enthusiast and to find out any of his journeys that he's done. Nick, welcome. And if you could tell me what Land Rovers that you own.
I own a Series 3 88 Land Rover, mm-hmm. Petrol. That's my first Land Rover I still have. It's not on the road, actually, but it stays with me for the rest of my life because it's the first one. And I own a 127 V8 from 1985.
1985.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what do you do by the day? Your occupation?
I'm a mechanic.
Oh, so in your element then, basically.
Yes.
Working on the rovers.
You could say so. I'm a mechanic as well in machining stuff.
Okay.
So behind yourself, you can see a lathe. So that's my trade too.
Trade.
So,
okay. Do you
I'm a mechanical engineer, but I can machine
machine too. So metal. You do any fabrications too for Land Rovers?
Yeah, it can happen, yeah.
Okay, you mentioned your first rover. What made you get involved with the rover? Did you, was it as a child or it, you know, family had it or just always seen him and wanting him?
As a child, every farmer used to have one because the Land Rover was just, it rules in Switzerland. Every farmer would have a Land Rover. And later on, I got stuck in winter with my car. Uh-huh. A Land Rover passed by. He didn't get stuck. And I said, I want a Land Rover.
That makes perfect sense. So, okay. So the Land Rovers are really big here and throughout Europe just because the farmers utilize the rovers. They can get anywhere and with the weather that y'all have.
And you used to have a shame when you were... When you get into the army,
right.
From day one, you had to give 5,000 Swiss francs from your own money, and the rest of it was the army, and you would do all of your service life driving your vehicle.
Okay.
And when the service is over, the vehicle is yours.
Oh, so, you get to keep the vehicle.
Yeah.
So when that,
and what could happen if the Russians would attack us?
Okay.
The army could say, you have to come in with your vehicle. Called in with your vehicle. But that made Land Rover very popular as well, because a lot of farmers or little businesses,
right.
There would be one of them, the sons usually, who got into service. That was in the 60s, mainly.
60s, okay.
Yeah. It's not no longer like that anymore, but it used to be like that in the 60s, and that was a big argument for having a Land Rover too.
Oh.
Because you go to the services for your basic training. After that, every year you go for 3 or 4 weeks. You start the service with servicing your Land Rover by army mechanics, professionally done.
Good. Okay.
You do your 4 weeks of service, and at the end, another service, and you go back home, do it daily business. A year later, you come back, service, army, service. It made perfect sense because you had a real good vehicle. And the army had a driver with his own vehicle who knows his vehicle.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that does
driving
make a lot of sense.
Driving skills make a lot of sense, yeah.
Right,
that made Land Rover very popular, actually, in the rural environment and within small businesses.
Okay. Yeah, that does make sense that with you in the army, you're driving that vehicle, you know the capability.
Yeah.
If it breaks down, you've repaired it, so you know how the vehicle runs in a circumstance.
You actually didn't even break down because it's your vehicle, you take care.
Right.
If it's the army vehicles, you say, wow. A lot easier.
Yeah, that's because sort of like back in the States, a lot of the young guys don't really know how to work on their vehicles.
Yeah.
Because they're so electronic or they don't want to. It wasn't like when I grew up, you know, you wanted to be by the car and learning how everything works.
Mm-hmm.
Just or be prepared. Even if you were a young woman, you got to at least know certain things.
Yeah.
So what year did you go in the Army? You had mentioned that over the weekend.
I was a grenadier in the Army. So that means mainly I got to drive a M113 American tank.
American tank? Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what we had.
Oh, okay.
And so...
And what year was that? Did you go into?
I went from 92 to when they finish about 2000.
2000? Oh, you served a long time.
Yeah, but you're not always in the army in Switzerland. We have a different system, actually.
Oh, okay.
We have some professionals, mainly the instructors.
Okay.
But we have a system where you get in and you do your time and you go and repeat every year. And
okay.
That for eight years. And then
you're done.
You reserve for 2 years and then you bring all your stuff back and you're done.
And then you keep your rover.
Yes.
So you were proud to have your rover.
I was too young for that, but I would have.
You would have. Okay. What do you do with your... I mean, you do your own adventures and everything? I mean...
Well, I got my Land Rover. Like everyone.
Right.
I got stuck. I said, I don't want to be stuck anymore in the snow. I want a Land Rover. Now,
right.
I got fever.
Right.
So I needed a Land Rover immediately for the money I have in my wallet.
Right.
Now. And I don't even think about it. What? It just needed to be a Land Rover.
Right.
Running. MOT. You pay. You put key in. You drive. And so I got to see one. And the man there said, well, go at least to some places. And so, and I went to some other places and they asked me, what do you want to do with my Land Rover? And I thought to myself, what a stupid question. Just sell me a Land Rover. I want a Land Rover now.
Right.
So I got myself, by luck, a very decent Land Rover Series 3 88 inch. Which, obviously, being a short wheelbase,
right.
is maybe not the ideal vehicle for overlanding, having a shortage of space. And load capacity,
right.
which I didn't understand at the time. But it was very nice to go off-road, and so I got to know Mark and his dad,
right.
Rolf. That was very funny, too, because my French was very bad. And when we met, he let me carry on in French, and I nearly mince-meated me tongue. And after 15 minutes, he went in perfect Swiss German, because that's where I grew up in Switzerland.
Right.
So I was much more familiar
with the German.
With that language. He goes on, just speak Swiss German with me, maybe it's easier. And so he told me, well, you get what you want to do is maybe better to have a 109, but then again, you have a very, very, very decent 88, so maybe you go on with that. So they were going off-road, and so in the early days, you would have some 90 V8s, big
right.
thing in the US.
Yes.
They would go, you know,
right.
and at the end of the trail, you have an old 88,
yeah.
kind of just, you know, just making it. That was our kind of thing. If they can make it, can we make it?
Right.
And in the early days, we had no axle articulation, so it was mainly we watched them how they passed easily, and we went, well, okay, third gear, vroom, vroom, vroom,
right.
and then off the clutch. Yes, let's fly over it. It was pedal to the metal, and then we got into the scales. And
right, so you learned a lot probably from Mark and his dad.
Sure.
You learned, okay, this is what I want in a vehicle, what I want to add to my vehicle.
Exactly, that was the beginnings, and then you make kind of Christmas tree out of a Land Rover
right.
because you want all the gear, but you have no idea.
Yes.
And then you come into, well, I don't need that. I take that off again and that off again and that off again, and you go back until you got more experience and you finally start doing trips. We went to a lot of Land Rover meetings in England, in France. We went to the desert. Tunisia at the time. Yeah, that was fun.
Was that a great trip?
Yeah, it was nice. It was a great trip.
An experience.
It was a great trip. It was we were two vehicles. One was a 110 TD5, brand
nice.
New, and the other one was a 1982 short wheelbase Land Rover, diesel petrol, long wheelbase, short wheelbase. It was good. It was really good. So we did quite a lot of trips. We made a big long trip around the UK, about 4 months. With my wife, we had big plans where to go, and then we had a look at our budget and said, okay,
right.
maybe too big a trip for the budget, so what can we do? What would we like to do the most of the whole trip? Well, we want to see Scotland, want to see Wales,
right.
we want to see England, we want to see Ireland, and all the Land Rovers who live there, because there are a lot.
Yes, it's very nice in England,
there
yes.
There is a lot to be
lot
seen.
To and good beer.
And good beer, and a lot of good stuff, and so so we finally went there for 4 months.
Four months? You did
touring.
like a 4 month holiday.
We made like a a 4 month sabbatical, let's say.
Right.
And
you were enjoying life.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Living in the moment, creating memories with your wife.
Exactly. Exactly. And we're still together.
Still together?
26
You met a woman that likes the outdoors and camping.
Yeah, she said the very day I brought this Land Rover, I hate this Land Rover. It's got more power upon you than me. And I said, well, you better get used to it, or you need
That's
a new
That's
what
guy. I like out in the States.
I said right from the start, get used to it or have another guy. Land Rover's going to stay. And so And so she went first into the Land Rovers of Switzerland board on the committee.
Yeah, when did you guys actually join the Switzerland
club? We joined the club in 1997, We got on the board in 2001, and we stood on the board for 12 years.
12 years,
yeah.
Wow.
She went 12 years, she did the website, and myself, I did event support, I did technical advisor, and I did 6 years of chairman, you could say.
Chairman, okay, like
yeah. Call it boss.
Boss. Like the, well, ours is the president, so
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, it's president, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. That's
yeah.
What it was.
And then you do, I'm assuming, because like at Texas Rovers, we plan a lot of events, you know, weekend trips, or sometimes we just do, you know, like, let's get together for dinner, because in the summertime in Texas, it's just too hot. But,
exactly.
But then a lot of times we'll try to do, like, road trips yeah. and everything. So you're similar, too, with the club?
Yeah, what we did is we made trips, let's say, for the, in a classical one in 2008 for a Land Rover anniversary.
Street,
yeah.
Right.
We went with the whole club with the Series 1s running. We took 6 series on their own wheels to the Land Rover World Show at Eastnor Castle. So we made, let's say, a trip up there. We did the show together. Yeah. And then we everyone went his own way, but some of them in pairs, and then got together for the journey back home.
Right.
Or we have journeys who they went with series vehicles in the Tunisian Sahara. So we had kind of 5, 6, 7, 8 series vehicles, but with more modern vehicles as backups as well. So
right.
Things like that. Or we go often to international Land Rover meetings, let's say when the Germans or Norwegians or Swedish Land Rover clubs, Dutch.
Right.
We go to them, to the anniversary parties.
Right.
Bigger trips. We go every year to, let's say, Luxembourg, because that's a kind of normal distance for what we are used to.
Right.
Yeah. And then we have the monthly club meetings, of course.
Yeah, we have those too.
Weekend activities within Switzerland, or we go together off-roading. We have, let's say, a group of people who like to participate in things like the Super Carpata Trophy in Romania, or the Croatia Trophy in Croatia. So more, let's say, competition off-roading.
Right.
Not rock crawling, because we have rocks, but we're not allowed to crawl
right,
them.
Right, yeah, that's something Mark had mentioned, that you guys really can't get off the beaten path. We're back, like, we've got off-road parks in Texas, or like in Colorado and Utah, we can actually get off
exactly.
the beaten path.
If we can go off the beaten track in Switzerland, is or we can get hold of Army grounds, which is very difficult.
Right.
And we can go to pay-and-play sites, but which are located outside of Switzerland, so mainly France and Germany, or Italy. And if we can go, let's say, off-road within short distance, mainly someone can get hold of a quarry site for a weekend.
Okay.
And then we can go there and play. But it's never, ever the same thing like if you go to proper
off-roading, yeah, because that's where you usually get to test your technical
exactly.
skills, learn exactly. things. Now, do you all in the club, like if you have what we call newbies, like someone who just bought a Rover, do you all provide training?
That would be me.
That would be you? Okay, so you're the trainer.
I'm, let's say, mainly the start of the club was there were meeting to get together technical help.
Right.
And exchange informations about overland trips mainly to Northern Africa? Yeah,
okay.
Most of them, yeah. Went to Algeria, Libya at the time, yeah. And then off-roading was not really their thing. But then again, when I got on the board, I said, if you want to use your Rover properly,
you need to know
how to run it off-road.
Right.
And how to operate it in off-road terrain. You need to get to know your transmission. You need to get to know your vehicle.
Right. Because even with y'all snow, you need to know.
Exactly.
And like back in the States, I have a coworker, and he drives a Range Rover. Of course, it's a, you know, Range Rover soccer thing. But the few times that we had snow, he'll comment coming to work, I was the only one that could keep going. Because he was in a Range Rover. Everybody else was sliding and slitting.
Exactly. So the main thing was, my main aim as a president was to provide at least once a year a possibility where you can make your first steps, where you get maybe teach the basic skills, and where you can try stuff out, even for the more advanced. But if you get it wrong, you're in Switzerland, you're with your friends,
right?
You're within very short distance of, let's say, medical care.
Right.
You should never go and venture, let's say, within about 200 kilometers of next medical help in the Sahara Desert.
Right.
And try something stupid and get it wrong and get injured and maybe even die.
Right,
not
yeah.
a problem. So that's, let's say, since 2008-09, we do that every year. Mainly on army grounds.
Army. Now, when you're talking about the training, does that include basic first aid training
yeah,
too?
Yeah, sure. And if they come, and some just they come out of showroom.
Right.
And some they have a Land Rover since long time, but they never really tried it off road.
Right.
Mainly, they could go and do the holidays in a VW camper.
Right.
Because it would even better suit their driving skills and what they do.
Right.
It's more economical, it's got more space and stuff, but that's the point. I want to go and do, let's say, an overnight stay somewhere in the wilds.
Right.
So it's more interesting to go where the campers can't go. I mean, the camping vans or caravans.
Vans, even, right.
First of all. And that was the aim. So now we have that and we teach them. It's basic, yeah?
Basic.
As slow as possible, as fast as necessary. Keep both feet on the ground, yeah?
Right.
Like you say, and don't avoid wheel spin.
Right.
Walk ahead.
Yeah.
It's really easy. It's not complicated, yeah?
Right. And how many members are in the club? Do you know? I know you're not on the board, but...
Now we are over 500.
500 members.
Yeah. I can't say exactly, but we're over 500 for sure by
okay.
now. Yeah, yeah, it's got quite big.
And then you do the Jubilee, well, you do the, I guess it's
every 5 years.
5 years, it's more, event. It's not a Jubilee, but it's a celebration from the date the club started.
We call it the Jubilee, yeah?
Jubilee, oh, so yeah. It's every 5 years.
Every 5 years we do a Jubilee event, yeah.
And then you usually get people from just all around the world.
Yeah, we got some Americans this year.
If we could have drove on the water, we could have gotten a lot furthest. We did come the furthest, but we didn't drive. We were the furthest.
Mostly the furthest drive from Norway or Sweden. We get all times English. We get obvious our neighbors. France, Germany, Austria, Italy, of course, but Belgium. We had 2 weeks ago a serious meeting that was international. The furthest travel was from Spain, and he traveled from Spain with his lightweight Ligero.
Right.
That's the lightweights that were built by Santana in Spain.
Spain, okay.
So that was quite a harsh ride.
Yeah.
But he did it.
He did it. Yeah.
And yeah, we get friends from all over Europe,
right.
And we had even someone from Namibia attending this year.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. What is on y'all's bucket list for you, your wife, and son?
Iceland?
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
So that would be your next trip you'd want to do?
Maybe not the next, but that's one we'd definitely want to do.
Do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Before we pass over.
Yeah, pass over. It might just be you and your wife once your son's out of the house and
yeah,
he's graduated.
I'd say my bucket list and wife's bucket list definitely is Iceland.
Iceland, okay.
It would definitely be one day Canada.
And if you come to Canada, you got to come over the States.
Of course. I'm just afraid to coming because I think I like it and I never come back to Switzerland. And on my own bucket list, if it's still running, then my son's grown up, I would like to take part the Croatia Trophy with me driving and he being my co-pilot.
That's a wonderful wonderful memory you'd create.
Yeah, exactly.
Those moments of life.
If it's still running there. He's only 7.5 years old now, so it's time to wait now.
One more question, and then I just want to get your feel, because I know a lot of us back in the state, even though we cannot get the Defender, but we will finally get the Defender, but we're wondering it's going to look like every other, you know, they make all the Land Rovers kind of look the same now, but all the vehicles kind of look the same. So what is your take on what they're going to do with the Defender? Are they going to kind of keep it because it is a farm, the farmers use it? Do you think it'll still look the ruggedness, or you think it's going to be a little bit more modern and aerodynamic?
Honestly, for me, in fact, they've done for me, like nothing until now.
Right.
They created a big farewell PR buzz.
Right.
Which is nice because you have got to honor the past.
Right.
And the past was great, extremely great.
Right.
Glorious even, I would say. But the future, they're talking a lot about connectivity, and I just like them very, very much to stay connected to work.
Work, the work vehicle.
Because not everything in life can be just done by an app on a smartphone.
Right.
In the end of the day, you got to take your hands and do something, and you need a real vehicle for that.
Right.
So I just hope, sincerely hope,
they don't
forget that.
Because you still need a work vehicle. Even back in the States, we have trucks, because you got to have that for the farmers, the cattle ranchers.
So I just want to keep it a working vehicle. We have enough premium vehicles by now.
Yes, we do.
And they're nice.
Yes.
Don't think I'm saying they're not good. They're really brilliant.
But there's still a lot of people who just want to...
I just like something that is really practical for work. That's what I would like, really.
Okay. Well, thank you.
That's my feeling. I'm hoping.
Keeping our fingers crossed.
I sincerely hope they don't forget us who work with them. Because in the end of the day, it's us who make the little boys dream. When you drive past the school with a Land Rover...
Right.
Even a working Land Rover, because they see more working Land Rovers than overlanding Land Rovers,
right.
Let's say. They all go dream modus on their eyes. Wow.
Yeah.
You know? Or you go and pick up your son somewhere, and there are other kids. They go, Dad, when are you going to buy that?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, my nephew.
And his dad is sitting in kind of a really nice Mercedes or BMW.
Yeah.
And I turn up with my old Land Rover, and... Those little lads just go on, oh,
yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, my nephew, I have an LR309, and my nephew, well, he's 21, but I'll go, can you wash my truck? And he, no hesitation, because he loves driving it. Of course, you get it back, the seats are reclined, and, you know, but it is, you know, they do like those type cars, you know,
exactly.
Those memories. So
we make them dream.
Yeah.
And when they grow up, they dream. And they maybe not buy a working vehicle, but they buy one of the premium vehicles.
Yeah, that's right. Then they can drive Dad around and then be there.
We're a part of their PR.
Right.
They know that.
Yeah, they know that. Yeah, they know that. Well, I really do appreciate your time, Nick, and answering my questions and just kind of giving a little background on you and your enthusiasm for Land Rovers. And we'll keep in touch. I'll get your email.
I sincerely hope.
Yes, and I'm on I'm on y'all's website and Facebook page.
Okay.
So I did like that. But I want to just thank you again for your time. And
much appreciated.
And hopefully you'll be on again one day.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm back with Nick. We had one more thing, and we were discussing how that, like in the Texas Rovers Club, how we bring everybody together from different walks of life, but the friendships that are developed, and I just wanted to get Nick's take on that, too.
Yeah, well, let's say I was driving across Switzerland on the motorway with my series, and I would see a 109 broke down, and it's just normal. You stop. And
right.
You try if you can help, or if you can get some help. And or more recent, this January, I got a call from a workmate. He was up the hills. They had a fondue plan together with their ladies, having a cheese fondue in the snow, and they broke a diff. I wasn't at all really at my workshop or wherever, but let's say at 10 or 11 at night, I got me stuff, what we need. And we went up there, and we got them unstuck.
Right.
Make sure that they don't break something else. And we go back home. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Of course, we had a drink. We had to. Everything was safe. And that sort of camaraderie that you can rely on each other.
Right.
In a way. That's what I think is just great within the Land Rover.
Community.
Community.
Yeah, totally. And that's just anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't matter. I once had a really, really nasty tire blown on an Italian motorway, and that was not fun at all. And I would have to drive with an underinflated tire to the next service station, and just looking through, because our Land Rover actually turned, and we were watching the others coming towards us, on the breakdown strip. And I could see a Defender coming, and I just thought, it looks tweaked. I'm sure he's got RB compressor or something on. I just waved, and he didn't know us. He stopped on the motorway, reversed back, and I said, mate, you got a compressor, an air compressor to give me some air. Yeah, sure. And he helped us. He helped us even out then, because you have a breakdown in Italy, you will have to deal with the carabinieri, the cops. Okay. So I'm not speaking Italian at all.
Right.
And even then, he helped us out with this. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, we have that back at home.
Total foreigner, total stranger. Yeah. He just drove a Land Rover too. That was all. We were in our old Range Rover. He was in his Defender. And we just got to know each other very quickly, helped each other out, and that was just amazing.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about, just helping. We had that at one of our events. Yeah. We had a gentleman that came over from Australia, and he was driving his Rover, and I don't remember what happened, some leakage or something, and the swarm of the guys that came, and he was just amazed. He's like, oh, my God, all these guys came to help me, you know, and he said, I just have never seen that. But that's just what it is. It's a helping hand.
We were at the Croatia Trophy on the night stage, and I think we could have been in the top three of the ranking.
Right.
And then we, driving along, we found a lot of people, and then it turned out that Jo and Peter from Holland went over the edge and just dived down a sandy cliff into the river, about 10 to 15 meters, and they were in the river, being strapped in the vehicles.
Wow.
So they just got out, and we could have said, okay, there's enough people to help.
Right.
We go on, and we think of the ranking, and we just, for us, it was just normal that we just don't care about the ranking.
Right.
We get them out, and then we go back to camp, and let's see what we can do that to make sure they can carry on the event.
Right.
And for sure, most important, they're not injured.
Right.
So that's what it's all about, and not about a ranking.
Ranking, yeah, it's amazing. Well, once again, we're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to have to let you go, but thank you so much again, Nick.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, show number 53, and this is our compliment interview to Nicholas Saunderer, who you just heard, who is a member of the Land Rover Club of Switzerland. This time we're talking to Sarah and Mark Caldwell, who are with the Texas Rovers Club, and you may have heard them on the show previously when I went down to SCAR. They had went with Laura to Switzerland and had a wonderful time at the Jubilee. Welcome, Mark and Sarah.
Hi, John. Thank
you. So you guys went with Sarah to Sarah. You are Sarah. You went with Laura. Yes, we're already doing well on the show. You went to Switzerland and attended the Jubilee, which is what, an annual? That's an annual event of the club.
I believe it's annual. They certainly kind of blow out every 5 years and do a big event. They mentioned this year that the next large event is actually next year in the Netherlands. So I'm not quite sure how big they do every year's event, but I'm sure they get it.
Yeah. I think they rotate between different clubs in different areas in Europe and then get that really big event on the every 5 years.
That's an interesting way to do it.
There's a lot of attendance from, you know, different countries. It was really quite interesting because there were so many languages. And luckily, English being the universal language, people from Norway were speaking English, four different languages in Switzerland. So, and none of them English, but everybody's second speaking, you know, language. So it made it interesting to communicate with the other trucks, you know, trying to find that common language, which was generally Defender.
How many trucks attended?
You learn all the different words for the same part. That's one thing that's cool.
Yeah.
And how many trucks were in attendance
this
year?
I think that's awesome.
There were just over 600 trucks in attendance, of which there were 13, 14 Discoveries, and the rest were either Series, Defenders, you know, some forward controls and things of that nature.
They had forward
controls.
Those proportions.
Yeah.
Forward controls? How many were there?
I would say maybe five or six forward controls, either ex-fire trucks or
there are ambulances.
Yeah.
A lot of conversions on different types of working trucks for expedition.
Now, are these mostly the 2B forward control, or are there some 101s there?
There were some 101s. Also some classic Range Rovers there, one LR3, but for the most part, Defenders.
Did they look at you funny when you called it an LR3?
Well, no, I mean, number one, they couldn't understand me, so it's not the language barrier, it's the accent barrier. I understand English, I just don't understand your English, you know.
Yeah, I hear you.
It was so rare to see, you know, Discoveries and the LRs.
For you folks living in Atlanta, which is infested by discos, that must have been a real culture shock for you.
It was a pleasant surprise to see a Discovery.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was surprised that the most of the Discoveries we saw were gas engines. They were not diesels.
Yeah.
Being in Europe, I was very surprised to see that.
Yeah, that's what we've learned. They really like gasoline.
If you're an enthusiast and a collector, the gasoline engine becomes the specialty thing in Europe.
That's true.
The diesel ones are just ordinary running around vehicles, and that's not something you take to the party.
Yeah.
Just some very beautiful early series trucks. We actually got to drive a 1950
series.
Yeah, Series 1, beautiful restoration. They had a whole collection of them, did a series parade through the town. Really fun.
Yeah, I saw the video of that. I'd have to say my favorite of all those in your video was the guy who had the dome light made from a candle lantern.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It takes a special kind of bravery to put combustible material, a flame right next to a combustible roof.
Yeah.
We asked, they said that was mostly for effect, you know, just for decoration, and they don't really light them. But it was pretty interesting to see, because a lot of them had that
gentleman that owned that vehicle only spoke German, and his name was Jorg, and
of course it was
a really, really nice guy, just over the top about the vehicle, covered it in a car cover in the evenings, trailered it to the event.
Well, you did say he was German.
Yeah. Babies the vehicle, just hands the keys over to a stranger and said, through translation, take it for a drive.
All right. Well, good for him.
And that was the Series 1?
It was. On the other end of the spectrum, we had a great opportunity to drive a 2013 110 Defender with all the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. Oh, what a great vehicle. I'd love to own this in another 13 years when I'm old. So
we'd all love to own it now if our government would let us.
It is not safe, Harold, for the United States. You know that.
Oh, yeah. It's not safe. Yeah, because the battery is under the seat. Yeah, that's why.
No, it does not have airbags. Did you get to drive that one around also?
We did. We actually drove it some distance. I would say that we covered probably 400 miles in our time in Switzerland. And,
wow. You
know, we got to drive off and on during all that.
I started to joke about the fact that it was, what was the Land Rover of the day going to be? Because our friends that we were visiting, Mark and Michelle Blazer, his family did own a dealership, and now he does repairs, and he has over 80 vehicles. Every day he would show up, it felt like he would show up with a different one that we got to go out and tour around with.
You know why he does that though, don't you? Because he can.
Yeah, exactly.
So mainly a 2013 110, 2007, which I believe is the last, I think he said it was the last year, the TD5 110.
Right.
And he had an 83 lightweight that was part of the Dutch military, just in pristine condition, tight, very tight vehicle. Yeah. Couldn't believe how well that drove, low mileage. So those were the three principal vehicles that we tooled around in.
Yeah.
Nice.
And you were there for, what, two weeks?
Yeah, about 12 days.
Was Land Rover event a camping event, took place in a town? Can you give us a sense of the event itself?
Sure. The event took place in a little town in the Bern province called Saint-Stéphane. There's a former Swiss military air base there that houses Hunter Hawker jet fighters from England in bunkers built into the side of the mountain. So it's basically an alpine valley with the Alps surrounding you on three sides. And the airfield has become quite popular. It's now a retired military base for car shows. So if you were to Google search St. Stefan, you would see American cars, British cars, all kinds of car shows that's held at this airbase. And basically, you camp alongside the runway.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw some photos on Instagram, and it looked very, very nice to be up, you know, halfway up the mountains, nice views, and just massive runway lined with Land Rovers.
Yeah, it was overwhelming to a degree to see so many vehicles, so many Land Rovers. And, you know, we always think that 100 Land Rovers in one place is a really great turnout. And to see 600, it was mind-boggling. It's very different there. Yeah, I think I went with an expectation that the off-roading would be sort of what we're used to here. And it's actually, you really can't off-road in Switzerland. There's really no place to off-road. They've paved everything. And if are roads that aren't paved, they're really going to a home or a business, and you know, you're not allowed to be on them unless you live here or belong there for some reason. Yeah. So they actually, our friends actually go to France to go off-roading in the manner that we would go off-roading. But all of these vehicles were set up for long distance expeditions. It was really interesting talking to people and seeing their maps of where they've been. And one gentleman had converted the ambulance and had gone all the way as far as you could go, probably in Russia.
Pretty far east of Russia.
Yeah. It's just a different style and a different lifestyle. The roads themselves were great. I mean, we were driving up, you know, 10,000 feet and on very interesting, curvy, small roads. But no rock climbing or anything like that. No, nothing that we would be looking to do here in the States.
No mud up over the bonnet?
No mud on any bonnets.
they clean it immediately, right, if it does get dirty.
The mud, yeah. And the organizer of the event did arrange for 3 organized drives. A participant would pay a nominal fee, which basically reimbursed the locals to open up roads that are normally not accessible to the public. So for those 3 days, at any time, assuming that you had, you know, paid the fee and gotten a little decal, you were free to take these drives up through the Alps onto roads that you would normally not be able to access. So that was pretty special because you really sort of had the road to yourself, and if somebody else was on the road, it was another Land Rover.
Must be absolutely amazing views up there.
Oh, the pictures were amazing that you guys posted. The Alps, it was amazing.
It was breathtaking.
Did you guys camp? Did you guys camp, or did you stay at a hotel or Airbnb or B&B itself?
We actually stayed at a hotel. Our hosts were just a little bit nervous about the weather, and they knew it was our first time in Switzerland, and I think they were determined that we were going to have a good time, so they weren't going to allow us to camp in the rain. It turned out to be perfect camping weather, and everybody that stayed there at the event really enjoyed themselves, whether they were on rooftop tents or just along the tarmac in the grass. They even had the local elementary school across the main road opened up so you could shower every day. It was really, you could see the parade of people in the morning heading across the road. Very, very well organized.
And the hotel was only less than 5 minutes. You know, the hotel's the main town, very close.
Sounds a lot like a North American Land Rover event. People queuing up to take a shower in some miscellaneous building, you know.
I'm still struggling to get past the idea of holding a rally where there is specified no rain. How do you have an event without rain?
That was really good fortune on your part.
Yeah. And the weather was beautiful. It was.
These folks needed to come to the monsoon Mars.
Right.
Yeah, been there, done that.
Yeah.
And you don't want stars turning into one that rains every year.
Another really interesting fact, if you just took all the trucks, especially the Swiss trucks, in perspective of what's different between that show and a show here in North America, is that in Switzerland, if you modify your vehicle, you want to put on a different bumper, maybe a winch, a lift kit, any type of typical modification that we would do to off-road our vehicle, you basically have to prove to the government that the accessory that you're putting on was specifically designed to go on the vehicle that you're attaching it to.
Yeah, so, I'm quite familiar with that. I have a customer who lived in Switzerland for a number of years, and he took his Range Rover with him, and he had to remove every accessory from the truck. And then he had to get special dispensation from the government to allow his tires because they weren't exactly the tires that came on it.
There is a process to quantify those. Mark Glazer, owning a Land Rover repair shop, he fabricates. And I was simply amazed at the level of detail that he did, not only just in the work and the workmanship, but in the notes and the photographs. He's got a room in his shop that's full of files. You pull a file down, you're going to see the schematics of the bumper. You're going to see the VIN number of the truck that it was built for, photographs along the way. And all of this is taken by the owner once the fabrication's done to the provincial inspection shop, which he actually took us to and we got the tour. And there's where you sort of lay out all the paperwork associated with the modification and the level of detail, how it is meant to meet or exceed the original manufacturer specifications.
Yeah, I always say the Swiss have no sense of humor when it comes to this stuff.
Not at all. And it really limits. You see a lot of Swiss trucks that are basically stock Land Rovers modified to glorious perfection when it comes to camping, but really set up to drive to the abilities of a stock Land Rover.
I heard you mention Series 1, Defenders, Range Rovers, Discoveries. There was a 4 Control. What about Series 2s, Series 3s? And I didn't hear the word that I need to hear because it is Friday. We're recording this on a Friday. It's Freelander Friday. I didn't hear about a Freelander.
You saw an LR2.
That's a Freelander.
And there were certainly Series 2s and 3s. They profiled in a unique parking section in the event, the Series 1 trucks. And then, of course, with the Series parades, the 1s, 2s, and 3s were invited. But certainly the 1s stole the show just because of the level of restoration that these trucks have gone through. It's just simply amazing, even to our standards here in North America, where we sort of go over the top in restorations. These were ever bit as much to the level of detail that they should have been. Yeah. Right down to the farm trucks with all the implements to take the milk out of the fields in the, Series 88 and back, back to the barn.
We did see somebody with a, what was the winch?
It was the Capstan winch.
Demonstrated that and that it was working. It was interesting to watch that. And they did a hat tip to an early Jeep, like probably first year Jeep, or there was one there.
Early post-war. That's one. Willis.
Nice.
Yeah.
I thought to your talking about the Swiss and what they allow in the country as far as modifications. Can vehicles visit that are modified? Or do visiting vehicles, do they even allow that?
No, I think that's fine. Certainly the trucks from Italy and the Netherlands and Germany, there were some lifted trucks there. Obviously, there were some trucks with modified bumpers and camper accessories, whether it's rooftop or full-out conversions and trailers. Very robust industry there in Europe. So I think that they had a vendor area, and that kind of ruled the vendor area as the modifications inside the vehicle or on top of the vehicle to allow for camping.
Yeah, expedition, really.
Yeah, that is a big thing over there.
Huge.
Well, would make sense if there's not places to wheel. Sounds like the overlanding style is makes sense. Plus, Britain, they have a lot of greenlanding, which is effectively just driving on a gravel road.
Yeah, I as a member of the ambulance owners groups, I'm probably the only person in the groups that's really not focused on camper conversions.
Yeah.
I mean, every discussion.
ambulatory issues.
Well, I mean, every discussion is about converting it to a camper. And I mean, I camp in mine when I go places in it, but it's also a working vehicle for me. It's my box truck, if you will. And so I use it for a lot of things, and I kind of like to keep it somewhat like it was intended. And it just makes me the odd man out.
The ambulance conversion we saw was the one that went to the western parts of eastern parts of Russia. So we'll get to some of those pictures. Vehicle was for sale, too.
If you want to build an RV out of a Land Rover, the ambulance is really the best place to start.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was a beautiful setup. It really was. Looked very comfortable.
Were you able to do any wheeling of any nature at all?
No.
Just a kind of green laning on those closed roads.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was exciting just driving on their streets, learning all of the different rules and making sure that you weren't breaking any of them was interesting.
Pretty strict.
Really?
Yeah. You come up to a pedestrian crosswalk, you cross the white line, police catch you, they confiscate your license, because in Switzerland that's considered losing control of your vehicle.
Yeah, again, no sense of humor.
None.
I haven't been more careful in my driving in years.
Wow.
Well, that's good for you, really.
Yeah. And we did a lot of driving to hikes, which was really interesting. It was a challenge. We would drive, hike, and then eat, like hiking up to a fondue restaurant at the top of the mountain, which was really, I guess, great on calories and unusual. You had to work for, and here we go through drive-thrus. So it's, without that much effort to get a meal was really interesting.
I suspect the quality of the fondue was much better than a fast food.
It was spectacular. So, beautiful country.
There's one word there, Sarah, you didn't use, and that was beer. Was there beer involved?
Yes.
Right down to being a part of the welcome kit that you got at the show.
they included a beer.
When you open your welcome kit and pull out a can of beer, you know you're in the right place.
Okay, so there are some good things about Switzerland then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we ought to talk to you about that for SCAR. Maybe you could get us some cans of beers for the welcome kit.
we can talk. There we go. Yeah,
We are outfitting his truck with keg racks. So.
Yes. you saw our truck. We've got how you put the tap in, how you can tap it. So mm-hmm. We don't have the beer. We have water, but we do have the beer tap. So
it's just as easy to change one line. You know, it's a tank. That's all. Same thing.
Looks better, John.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Call it water. It's because beer is just processed water, after all.
Exactly.
Well, it's flavored water.
Used to be much safer to drink than the water.
You had to drink beer because it was, in fact, right. It was better for you than water because it was processed. All the crap was removed from it. So how high up were you, and did the trucks have any special modifications deal with higher altitude?
Not really. The show probably took place around the 1 mile mark. And I think the highest roads took us just over 8,500 feet.
Okay.
So you'll feel it, but it's not prohibitive.
I mean, you've got Series 1 trucks running around up there, too.
Yeah.
Just, doing their own time, but not mm-hmm. certainly.
What about that?
They never go fast, so, what's the difference?
We ran across a 1920s.
1923 Bugatti.
Right on.
Yeah.
That was pretty exciting.
Yeah, just out for a drive.
Amazing.
Which is what I would do if I had one. I'd just go out for a drive.
So true.
You got to use them.
Not every day, but I would be doing it. Absolutely. If it was a nice day out, sure, I'd take it.
You were at an airfield. There were 600 roughly Land Rovers. Where did they come from? I know you mentioned it before, but I take it all over Europe. Or is there anybody from Asia? Anybody come in from Africa? I'll assume no North Americans.
Yeah, there was a vendor from South Africa, mm-hmm. and there may have been a couple more participants there. I don't remember if they brought their vehicles or not. Certainly all over Western Europe. We ran into some expat Texans that was kind of nice because we saw a Texas flag on a tent. They saw Texas flags off the back of the Defender, and sometime in the afternoon of day two, we ran into each other. So that was pretty interesting.
That's cool.
So somebody you could speak to and understand.
Right down to the accent.
Right. Yeah. They were living in Frankfurt, Germany. I think he's teaching languages there. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Then he's become a Texas River member, and hopefully maybe we'll get a chance to go visit them in Frankfurt.
But it was, but overall, I mean, it was an extremely polite and friendly group of people. They were just, they were glad we were there to kind of see the way they do things, and kind of unlike Great Britain or even the United States, where you get magazines that kind of, if you're a Land Rover enthusiast, you can kind of flip through the pages, even if you don't speak the language, and see what are people doing for fun with their Land Rovers in this country or that country. Well, Switzerland doesn't have a Swiss Land Rover magazine. So I think they were glad to see us coming over and investigating how they celebrated, you know, life with Land Rover.
I hope you push the podcast.
Oh, I have to say, Laura was handing out your stickers. They're probably floating all over the world at this point.
Good.
She was handing out stickers to everybody, all kinds of decals. So, there was a nice stack. I think you had given her a stack of them.
I did.
So she was definitely making sure people had that information. I tell you what, John, that one of the things that was so incredible about this event in comparison to what we do here in the States, their meals were like fine dining, you know, 600 people in a tent, and it was all wine, crystal, china.
You know? Sure.
The paper placemats were made specifically for the event, and then sprinkled on top of the paper placemats were little pieces of rock to let you know that, you know, this is a Land Rover.
Wow.
Breakfast was to die for. I mean, you know, every bread, fresh bread that you would expect to have in France, and cheeses and meats and fruits. And I mean, just, I've never seen food like this at an event. We're used to getting some barbecue slapped at us and some dried out chicken or something like that.
Well, sounds like the next SCAR is going to have to really up its game.
Yeah, we are. We need to.
we did bring away some really unique ideas from this event. In thinking about next year's SCAR, now translating that to actually putting them into practice is another matter. But certainly for topics of conversation, how do you make SCAR better? We learned some really, really good stuff over there at that event. So it just another positive coming out of making that journey over there.
Anything you wish to share?
Well, I mean, for example, you can envision a small billboard plastered with the sort of the calendar of events for the 3-day meet with maps and photos, timetables. I mean, that's just really nice to have. I mean, done first class. And I think that being someone new to that event and them having it in three different languages, I just think that was a really nice touch, so that as with most things, you get a welcome packet. Mm-hmm. You throw that in the back of your truck, and then you know, you're cleaning your truck out on your way home and say, oh, well, here's what happened during that event.
I missed that. Yeah.
Or a month later when you're going through your stuff.
I got the rap tickets out, but that was about it. This is sort of in your face as you go to the main pavilion, and it just kept you up to date with here's what's going on where.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I dragged my feet, and we missed the helicopter ride that Mark really wanted to take.
Wow. Helicopter ride? Come on, give us more.
Yeah.
Five and 10-minute helicopter rides for really a great price. I mean, just take you up above the local mountains so you could look down at the valley and, you know, maybe photograph the trucks on the tarmac, you know, from a distance.
That would have been killer.
Wow. The history of just that town, they opened up one of the bunkers and we were able to tour the planes. One of them is still, they still fly it by a certain amount of hours every year. And just to see how they're built and to get a look into the Swiss Army, what they require of their people. I mean, you know, we've always all heard that, you know, Swiss are neutral, and you sort of think, well, they're neutral because they're protected. Well, they've got some pretty interesting requirements. Of turn 18, you become part of their reserve. You train, they give everybody in the country has a gun. you know, they're very well set up to defend their country if they ever thought they were under invasion. And these bunkers exist all over the country where the population can sort of go into these bunkers if they were ever under attack. And you know, the stores and everything were just incredible.
The blast doors.
Yeah.
To Sarah's point, the entire, from what we learned, the entire Swiss population can go underground. Every road, every rail line, every means to enter the country is set up to be demolished the instant that the invasion takes place. So, you know, you cross into Switzerland by train or road, you're literally driving over explosives waiting to go off.
And then, not.
You know, up until, you know, 3 years ago, you got fresh bullets from the government to replenish your, you know, and refresh your bullet supply for the guns that they've issued you when you gave up your year of service.
Yeah, we actually saw some people with old series trucks that had these baskets, and it looked like they had, there were armament in them.
Yeah, they were wicker mortar head carriers designed to go across the backs of horses.
Nice.
So they could take the mortar rounds up to the mountaintops, and then they had converted this to roughly a ground sitting picnic table.
Yes.
Really nice. We still had quarters in there too, just as a, as effect.
Being car people, we love our props. And the props that we saw at this event were just over the top.
I mean, we need to get some of those here.
Yeah.
Definitely a conversation piece.
Yeah. Learned a lot.
And from the interview Laura did with Nick, it sounded like they helped provide the vehicle. Or at least they did, and so many people chose Land Rovers during their service, and then they, you know, get to keep the vehicle in case of an invasion.
Sir, I think, from my understanding, certain people were allowed to do that.
Officers, or
It was mostly people from rural settings.
Rural settings, that kind.
That they could use it on the farm, but it was always to be maintained and stocked with the provisions that particular Land Rover was designed to do. You know, we would pass an army base and they said, you see that base over there? Well, that's specifically a base that maintains portable bridges to cross rivers. They had these little small army bases all over the place with specific jobs in mind. And I think that's the way the Land Rovers were set up, was, you know, your job when you are called up is to do this function, and therefore this Land Rover is going to help you do that function.
That's impressive.
So apparently the Swiss are quite the planners.
Yeah.
Well, but if you think about it, it's real easy to say that you're neutral. But in order to stay that way, it takes a lot of infrastructure, a lot of planning, and a lot of readiness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. It's, you know, you think about the countries you want to invade and the ones where you have high percentages of private citizens owning their own their own weapons. Those are the ones you scratch out fairly early.
Really interesting, because we stayed with Mark and Michelle in their home. And by the front door, there was he had a loaded rifle there right by the front door. So that's how seriously they take their preparation.
Yeah.
And we weren't in an area where he would need that for wild animals or anything like that. because we were in a lovely little town, but he has some really interesting, you know, sort of on the military side of things, had some really interesting vehicles. Mark, can you talk about the prototype that he has?
He has a prototype 110 Defender pickup truck, soft top, that was sent over to be evaluated by the Swiss, and through some loophole, these trucks are destined to go back to the factory. This thing never did, and years later, someone unearthed it, and Mark was able to obtain it. And that's a very hard thing to do in Switzerland, you know, as we previously talked about. Inspections, well, the titling process in Switzerland is no less as impressive in terms of having all your I's dotted and T's crossed, but it took about a year and some letters back to the factory, but that vehicle is legal. It's one of one, virtually no miles, and a pretty interesting vehicle, soft top 110 pickup truck.
The really interesting part was there were some boxes in the back when we got to them, and the person had no idea what were in them, and when he opened them, they were factory.
A complete set of factory tools to service the Defender.
Wow.
Nice.
Probably worth as much as the Defender itself.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what year was it again? I'm sorry, I missed that.
You know, I'm not completely sure. It was an early 80s vehicle.
Okay.
But I'm not quite sure what year it was.
I would estimate it somewhere between 1983 and 2015.
That's a
pretty it's a good safe thing. Yeah. But safe.
But it falls in consistently with what it should be.
Nice.
He had some really interesting fire vehicles, fire engines. Just and I can send you. I'll link you up some pictures on those. Just yeah. really incredible.
He does the restoration himself, or
he does them. But you know, like all mechanics and running their own shops, the amount of time he has to dedicate to that is limited. So,
really?
Yeah.
You don't say.
Did he have any other interesting one-offs or other Land Rovers? How many does he have? I guess that's another good question.
We toured some warehouses. He has several. I mean, some of these are basically customer vehicles that when they got the diagnosis, hey, you know, sorry, but your chassis is literally gone. They didn't want to invest the money. So you got, you know, wonderful Series 3 trucks of all sizes with just bad chassis, but great bodies, great interiors. He's got a number of earlier vehicles, you know, Series 2, Series 1s that were just too good to let go, you know, as they come.
He has some rally trucks too that have history. His sister actually has done some rallies. She has a beautiful Defender 110.
And he rallied too as a young man. So there's quite a varied group of Land Rovers there in his possession now. You know, how many do get out and get exercised? I really don't know.
I don't think that many of them, but we sort of guesstimate around 80 vehicles, maybe including some other brands.
Sure.
Yes, some minis, which we're interested. You know our history with minis, and it's interesting to see that. And incredible parts department. If you on some of these older vehicles you guys have, you may have parts that you would need or want.
That's what I was hearing. Yeah. Hey, you know, Morgan.
Always good to know.
Morgan has seriesparts.com. Maybe you could do something there, Morgan. Help. Help the community.
Yeah.
Totally.
Do a cross link to seriesparts.ch.
Right.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, it's nice to hear that so many of those vehicles are preserved within Switzerland's protected borders.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so they're clearly well defended.
They'll still be there for a while.
Are they in bunkers too? Does he have a bunker that he has all these trucks?
they're basically just various warehouses.
We took a tour. It was some of them were quite distant from where he is in different towns. So we got to see a lot of the countryside as we. So that was a big part of our trip, was visiting all of his warehouses.
Well, that's what my priorities would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed.
Yeah.
You can see the Alps on TV, but, you know.
I suggest wholeheartedly it's a trip that is well worth it for and to do it when they're having an event. They actually had two pretty big Land Rover events back-to-back, and Mark had wanted us to come for both of them, but we ended up just letting them go to the other one and come for the Jubilee, since that was the really big one.
And the Jubilee is an annual event. That's at least our understanding, right?
That's our understanding as well. I just don't know how big it is.
And again, I think what they do is they sort of pass the baton to another country to do the next year.
Okay.
And they have small... Like, it would be a much smaller group of just Swiss people getting together. And then every 5 years, it becomes this huge event where everybody comes in.
Sort of like here in the United States, with you got the national rally, which club's going to host the national rally.
Right.
It's sort of like that.
Oh, how long was the event?
3 days.
Very nice.
It's a nice side. I was just going to say that, the moving from country to country would be a lot like for us if, say, everybody was going to SCAR this year and then we're going to MAR next year.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly the way it is.
Yeah. If you move the national rally, call it the national rally, and you just move it to a different state or a different club host it. Yeah, that would be an interesting idea, actually.
But, I mean, that's kind of how the size, you know, Europe is close enough together that they can do that. It's a lot like us going to the next state over to,
right.
to an event.
So I'm hearing a lot of Land Rover community, and that community that we've experienced here in the United States and in certainly in the UK seems to have extended to Europe and to Switzerland. Would you agree with that? That there's no matter where you are, everybody bleeds green.
There was certainly a sense of community. A lot of these people that we were introduced, obviously they knew each other and had known each other for years. We met one gentleman that had attended every national Land Rover event for the past 30 years. In fact, he was wearing a T-shirt from the very first meet. So,
was he the one with the painted vehicle?
Blue Hotel.
Yeah, the Blue Hotel.
He has a Mitchell B-25 bomber radio in the back of his Land Rover.
Ooh, there we go.
Nice.
You saw a picture of him in that video that I sent along.
Yeah.
This is just a perfect example to me of what the Land Rover community and family is, because Mark and Michelle, their son came to Texas to do a year as an exchange student, and while he was there, they came to SCAR. And
they came to visit him.
Yeah.
Looked around at what's happening over here, Land Rover related, and discovered SCAR that way.
Right.
Less than 2 hours from where he was living.
So they came to SCAR, and Mark speaks fairly good English, Michelle a little bit less, but you guys know Laura and the group down there, and they just became part of that Texas Rovers family. And Mark, wherever they go, they take the Texas flag and take pictures and send us. And they just extended this invitation for anybody that's part of the club to come and stay with them. We've had other club members that were over there for business and, contacted them, and they just rolled out the welcome mat for them, and they did the same thing for us, and it was just incredible. And we're hoping that we can get them to come back. They usually take the month of July off, and we're hoping next July they'll come and we'll show them parts of the United States that they haven't seen. And it just opens up the world. I said to Mark, we need to see if we could find a Land Rover over there, a Defender, and buy it and see if we can get Mark to store it for us, and then we could go and just fly to Switzerland and go on expedition from there.
That's a good plan.
Definitely an interesting idea.
In the Land Rover community, there's the wave as two Land Rovers pass. Does that still apply in Switzerland, where the laws probably don't allow you to take your hands off the steering wheel even to change the radio?
It certainly does. In fact, there was such a concentration of Land Rovers around that small village. You were only doing one hand driving because you were waving every 10 seconds at a passing lander. And everybody waved. So, it's like being in the South. You're going to wave too, right? So certainly there was a lot of that.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming to the show and talking about the Jubilee and the Land Rover Club of Switzerland. Thanks very much for coming on and joining us. And Sarah, I have a personal question. What's going on with the Rebel Rally? Can we talk about that?
Well, as far as my participation or?
Yes.
So obviously this year has been quite busy for me. We're actually leaving tomorrow for Colorado for 10 days. So we're in the process of packing up to head out there. But we had already had this Swiss trip scheduled and this trip to Colorado scheduled. So I've actually decided to put off till next year to participate in the Rebel. My navigator, very interesting. Joe's really interesting. She actually spends a lot of time in Algeria, and she's going back over to, and I can't even pronounce the country, borders Russia. She actually does mapping and navigation. She's planning a cross-Sahara trip on her own. The only thing that's wrong is she's a Jeep girl. So we're trying to get the whole Jeep Land Rover thing,
We need to put together some sort of deprogramming center for people with this problem.
Well, she's planning to do this. And I'm like, why do you want to do it in Jeep? There's you're in Land Rover world. And she says, because it'll be so unusual for me to do it in a Jeep. She needs to spend some more time in a Land Rover, then maybe she'll come over from the dark side. But
if she wants to do it in an unusual vehicle, there are unusual Land Rovers to do it in.
Yes, that's true. our plan is to, we've decided to put it off and do it next year.
That's fine. The podcast will still support you. I'm still not sure how, but we're still going to support you even next year.
Well, now, you know, you brought up beer. So, I'm, you know, when we hang up, I'm going to talk to Laura about seeing if you can get us some of your beer to put into our, our welcome goodie bags.
That's a good idea.
I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe not a good idea with the fun zone. They bring enough beer, so it might not be as great.
A growler in every bag.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's starting to ramp up. I'm getting emails every day on preparation for the Rebel. It looks like it's going to be another really incredible event and one that I do really want to participate in. The idea of just crossing some of those areas without any navigation other than maps and compasses. I need to step up my game on desert driving, so I'm looking at maybe spending some time this winter out in the Anza-Borrego or Glamis and you know, just spend some time driving out there, because other than driving on beaches, which I don't think really counts, I've not done any true desert driving. I mean, you know, Moab and those areas are not dunes, so.
Well, take a page from the Swiss and do a lot of planning, right?
Yes. Are you going to, you start doing your trek across the country? Are you going to do any dunes driving later?
I don't know. Probably, I don't know. That's it. right now.
You got to, right time of year. You got to be the right time of year. But, if you're going to go see this country, don't forget those areas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Really different, just totally different than what I'm used to. So pretty excited about that.
Well, good luck with the Rebel Rally when that does come up, and we'll have you back on the show to talk about the Rebel, maybe before and after. Definitely after, because
during.
During. Oh, even.
She'll be focused on the rally.
You know, they don't really allow communication.
They don't.
Yeah.
You hand in your cell phone.
Yeah, they do take your cell phone away from you.
Lovely.
Yeah. I think there is, they do make some media concessions, it has to be done through their lines of communication.
I get that they don't want you making calls and cheating on the navigation part, but, you know, an evening wrap-up or something after the event
I think they do have some accommodations for that. I don't know exactly how they do it, but I think they do have it through what they set up, you know. Cool. So you would go to one of their areas and just do a recap, like you said.
Which would be fine. We can get them involved, too.
Yeah.
It would be a little too tempting to cheat with a cell phone with GPS in your pocket the entire time while you're
I get that, definitely. But, once you're in for the day, they could let you make a call, you'd think.
Yeah, I think they do. But, again, it would be across their systems. I don't think they give you back your phone. I know they allow, like, for an area where you can go and make calls, and that's probably supervised just to make sure of it. Nobody's doing anything they shouldn't be doing.
Well, Mark and Sarah, thanks for joining us on the show today to talk about the Land Rover Club of Switzerland and the Jubilee, and also a little bit about the Rebel Rally. So we look forward to hearing more about the Rebel when it comes up.
And I look forward to seeing you, John, when you get down this direction.
And that's the show for this month, August 2017. I want to thank all our contributors. Thanks to Harold for joining us from La Trobe. You're going to go back to working on the 110, right?
Yeah, I'll be off doing something important somewhere.
And thanks to Morgan up in the Green Mountain State. Morgan is the purveyor of seriesparts.com. Don't forget to visit that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
And should we be watching soon for seriesparts.ch?
It's not a bad idea, although they probably have some rules for buying Swiss domain names over there.
Not to mention purveying parts that don't meet original spec.
Right.
I think the domain sits in a bunker, and you have to defend it. Have the locals defend it. So find the closest bunker. I have no idea.
SD would need to be armed as well, I take it.
And I want to thank Morgan personally for helping to fix our local Land Rover Club website, because it had some issues, and I just didn't want to deal with it myself. And Morgan, thank you for taking the time to help out get that site back up and running.
You are entirely welcome, and I'm happy to finally have created my account on that site.
Yes.
I don't know why I hadn't before.
You finally joined the forum.
Yeah, why are you not a member?
I don't know. I've read threads on it before, and I just assumed I still had an account, but apparently I didn't. So now you do. Now I do.
Also, thanks to the One True Pax for his production support, and happy birthday to his son who turned 18. And because I, you know, when I met Pax, he doesn't look like someone who should have an 18-year-old son, but he does. So thanks to Oval News and Roverhall.com. We're working to take over Centersteer.com from them. That's in the American spelling. Just in case. I don't know if it's been an issue, but why not? We'll try to get Centersteer and the American spelling under our stable.
So in the future, no matter how you spell it, you'll still be able to find us.
Well, you still have to spell it correctly in one one language or another.
Well, you have to be able to spell steer as well.
True. We're not going to go crazy.
I
hadn't thought about all that, but you're right. It's like, oh yeah, it'd be fun. No, it won't. You still got to spell center and steer right, yeah. And .com. And
well, if you can't spell .com by now, you really have no business being on a computer.
I hope you enjoyed show 53. Thanks for listening. A reminder to visit our website for past shows and show notes. We should have links to things we talked about today, especially the photos. Sarah's going to send me a link to the photos of their trip to Switzerland. You can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and even Instagram now. We have an Instagram account. Post pictures there occasionally. And I don't repost others. You can't repost others. You can also directly support the show at patreon.com/centersteer. And thanks again to our new Patreon subscribers. I did use some of that money to buy more stickers, so we have more stickers. If you anybody, especially Patreon people, would need another sticker, let me know. Well, we'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. Next show should take place at the usual time. I will hopefully, right, Harold, be on the road when that happens.
I hope so.
Me too. Until then,
I'm ready to be rid of you and your truck.
Until then, I ask you to share the show with another Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by.
Get to go to Switzerland without having to remove our bumpers and winches.